From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. In the late 1950s, several influential radio disc jockeys were discovered to be accepting bribes for playing records. On this edition of Fresh Air, journalist Frederick Dannon on the new payola that influenced what you heard and didn't hear on radio in the 80s. Also today, we meet director Jerry Zucker. He was one of the three filmmakers behind the comedies Airplane and The Naked Gun. Now he's on his own with the new movie Ghost. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews two new reissues by Rossa and Roland Kirk. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg explains why speaking another language makes you change more than just your words. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Remember the payola scandal of the 1950s? Several radio DJs were accused of accepting bribes in return for playing records. Some people went to jail, there was a congressional investigation, and payola seemed to disappear. But in 1986, the NBC Nightly News ran a series of reports on the new payola. Their charges have led to two congressional investigations, a Los Angeles federal grand jury investigation, and several indictments. My guest Frederick Dannon has written a new book, Hitmen, about the new payola and other corrupt practices in the rock music industry. According to Dannon, the new payola is different from the payola of the 50s.
What happened is sometime, I think in 1978, an organization was formed called The Network. The Network consisted of about 6 to 8 key men who were based in different cities in the United States, who had carved the country up into personal territories. Your territory consisted of a group of top 40 stations over which you had influence. The record labels were paying you, if you were a member of the network, anywhere from $100,000 to $300,000 to promote one record. So some of the top members of the network were making tens of millions of dollars a year. The way that you had control over those stations in many instances was through bribery. You were taking the large sums that the record company was giving you, and you were converting them to cash, which you were paying to program directors at radio stations. Either you were giving them an envelope full of cash, or you were sending them a Federal Express envelope with cocaine, or you were providing them with prostitutes in some cases, you were taking them out, you were giving them some kind of gifts or other form of compensation. But one way or another, you had influence over them.
Why did the record companies, who had their own promotion departments, buy into this independent network of promotion people?
Well, one thing your promotion department couldn't do was to guarantee a specific station with regularity, the way the network seemed to be able to do. Remember, the top 40, which is the most important format, the one that really breaks pop music, is a very tight format. There are 40 slots, sometimes fewer than 40 slots, and most of that list carries over from week to week. So your local promotion guy simply wasn't going to be able to do the trick with regularity. After all, the record industry releases something like 200 new singles a month. So the competition for a spot on that playlist is absolutely fierce.
So you're suggesting that the independent promotion people could buy their way into the top 40, but the record companies themselves wouldn't feel comfortable having their own promotion department hand over bribes.
They needed the insulation. The network people, in effect, most of them, were bagmen for the record companies. This was a way for the record companies to deny that they had any knowledge of what was going on if something ever went wrong. In fact, the contracts that they issued to the network promoters contained a clause that forbade them to give payola, which is interesting in itself when you think about it, why that clause should even have even been necessary. But the record companies could just, and would periodically, when questioned about them, say, "I don't know how he does it, but he's very effective."
What forms did the bribery take? Was it always just literally giving people cash in an envelope or drugs in an envelope, or were there other more insulated forms of bribery?
It varied. For example, Joe Isgro, who was one of the key members of the network, goes on trial August 14th in Los Angeles in what's going to be the biggest payola case ever tried. He was indicted on 51 counts, including not only payola, but drug trafficking. His top lieutenants, Ralph Tashchin and Bill Craig, were convicted already. I'm not saying Isgro is going to be convicted, but they pleaded guilty. And they confessed, among other things, to sending cocaine to program directors in Federal Express pouches. One program director I'm aware of used to get a weekly birthday card. He would go to a post office box that had been set up for him by the independent promoter, by the network man, and every week he would get a birthday card brimming with $50 and $100 bills. Sometimes they would send empty cassette boxes with money stuffed in them. One program director would hold a sleeve of a 45 up to his ear that contained cash and shake it and say, "Sounds good." These are some of the stories of which I've been made aware. There probably were other methods.
What about methods like hiring a program director as a consultant and for not really doing any work and therefore giving them a lot of money, but on paper it looks like it's a service that's being performed. It's not a bribe.
Well, this was the biggest problem that the system had, apart from the sheer illegality of it. You could not be absolutely certain that the record you were paying all this money for was even being played. Because since there was this relationship between the network promoter and the program director, and let me clarify that, the program director is the person at a radio station who makes up the playlist. So that is the person you want to influence. Since there was this relationship between the network promoter and the program director, if you had an arrangement whereby the network man was going to be paid a bonus for landing a specific station, the only way that you could tell whether the station was, in fact, playing your song was through a publication called Radio and Records, the industry's leading tip sheet. So all the program director had to do, he didn't even have to play the record. He could just lie to Radio and Records, tell the magazine he was playing the song. And this was known as the paper ad. Paper ads began to flourish right around the time the network was formed.
Did the record companies basically start this network of independent promotion people?
It's hard to say exactly. I think what happened is that certain key guys, and some of them, by the way, had mob ties, were just aggressive about developing control over certain key stations. I think there actually was this meeting. I've heard a number of people discuss it in 1978. At which some of the most powerful consultants got together and formed this cartel. It was actually an alliance in the sense that everyone knew who had what station. And on occasion, if one network man tried to poach on another network man's territory, there could be bloodshed.
In your book, Hitmen, you suggest that one of the things that was in it for the record companies to go through these independent promotion men was that if you had to buy your way onto the playlist, the major labels could do it, the independent labels couldn't. So this was a way for the major labels to eliminate the independent labels as competition.
Absolutely right. And in fact, around 1978, when the network was formed, you began to see independent labels disappear from the top 40 charts. It was only in 1986, after the record industry temporarily started to boycott the network after it had become much too expensive, that a small independent label like Profile Records was able to get a single in the top 40. If you were to try and promote legitimately and just depend on free market forces, you would often lose out to an independent label because the independent label had a better song.
But why couldn't your if you were a major label, your promotion department had much more muscle than any independent label promotion department ever could.
I know, but if they had the better product, what were you going to do? If the radio station started playing it, well, for example, rap has come out of the independent labels. Rap is now very big. Profile Records came out with Run DMC, and it was unstoppable. The market wanted it. it's almost always been the small independent labels that have come up with the new styles. The major labels tend to imitate each other and to latch onto fads. Disco also started with the independent labels. Rock and roll, for that matter, back in the 50s, came out of small independent labels like Chess and Specialty and Dot. It wasn't coming out of Capitol. Capitol was, or CBS for that matter. CBS was putting out Doris Day and Ray Conniff at the time that Chess was putting out Chuck Berry.
How did the network, this small group of independent promotion men, come to dominate the record industry that had created it?
Well, the dominance came through fear. As I said earlier, their power was not to make a hit record, it was to prevent one. And the story that opens Hitmen, of course, is that of Pink Floyd. They had the number one album at the time, The Wall. This was early 1980. They were performing in Los Angeles at the Sports Arena, which held 16,000 people. They had it booked for five consecutive nights. And yet, at that time, not one top 40 station in Los Angeles would play the single from that album, Another Brick in the Wall, because CBS Records was experimentally boycotting the network in that region for that one song. Well, CBS Records got a very dramatic lesson in the power of the network. And remember, this was 1980. The power of the network hadn't even peaked. It was only really about 2 years old at that point. But the day that Dick Asher, the deputy president of CBS Records, finally relented and agreed to allow the network to be paid for promoting that single, it was on three of the four biggest top 40 stations that day in Los Angeles.
So the network had the power to
prevent a record.
To tell stations to not play a record as well as to suggest that they play it?
That was the source of their power. They really couldn't make a hit record. Only the market can really do that. You can saturate the airwaves with an uncommercial song and have some moderate success. But in the end, if it's going to be a hit record, it has to be in the grooves, as they say in the industry. I'll give you some examples, or one good example. Carly Simon's single, Jesse. Warner Brothers paid, I've been told, $300,000 in independent promotion fees to get that on the radio. And it went top 10, but nobody bought the album. Nobody really wanted it. There were recent singles by two groups on Virgin, T'Pau and Cutting Crew, that went top 5, and their albums were stiffs. The real power these guys had was that they could keep a record from being played. That enabled the major record companies, the six big companies, CBS, MCA, Warner, Capitol, Bertelsmann Music Group, and Polygram, to have a virtual chokehold on top 40 radio at the expense of the independents.
How could the independent promoters prevent a record from being played?
Well, they would go to the program director over whom they had influence. And remember, if you're feeding someone's cocaine habit, you have a lot of influence over that person. You would go to the program director and say, don't play this single. It was as simple as that.
I guess one of the things that confuses me about the power that you say these independent promotion men had, it would make it seem as if every program director, every music director at a top 40 station was a cocaine addict or was corrupt enough to accept pay for play.
They didn't all have to be. To get a single on the charts in Billboard, you need to get a certain number of key stations. What you usually did was you would turn to the leading record industry tip sheet, which is Radio and Records, and look at their top 40 survey. They basically polled 200 key stations around the country to make up their charts. So for starters, you could ignore any station that wasn't on the Radio and Records survey. If you wanted to get your single on the charts, you just had to concentrate on the stations that were being used by Radio and Records. Then you only had to get a certain percentage of those stations in order to get a chart position. And that's where all the concentration was placed. I mean, this is one of the ironies of the network. You could have a single that was on the charts as top 5 or top 10, and nobody was really buying it, or not enough people were buying it to justify it being there.
The current FCC payola rules were basically written after the 60s payola scandals. And since that kind of payola is different from the kind of payola that's developed since, are the current payola prohibitions the right ones to prohibit what's been happening in the 80s?
No, absolutely not. They're absolutely outdated. First of all, the maximum penalty under that congressional statute of 1960 for payola, for starters, it's a misdemeanor. The maximum penalty is 1 year in jail and a fine of $10,000. To date, absolutely no one has served a day in jail for payola. Kenny Gamble, who was probably the first person convicted under that statute, Kenny Gamble was the Philadelphia record producer responsible or partly responsible for such groups as Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes and the OJs, was convicted under that statute in 1975 or 76, and he was fined $2,500. That was his punishment. So it's a toothless statute, and the FCC, of course, is not really an enforcement agency. It's not like the SEC. The SEC was able to mount a very effective campaign against insider trading, and we've been able to see the deterrent effect of that already. It's had an impact. Unless Joe Isgrow is convicted, or if he is willing to or willing and able to turn evidence against record industry figures, that is, executives in major record companies, I don't think there is any deterrent. You know, the network, to quote a Talking Heads song, it's the same as it ever was. It's back. They were gone for a while after that NBC News report in 1986. But apart from Isgrow, who has his legal problems, the same players are back doing the same things.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is journalist Frederick Dannen. He's written a new book called Hitmen about corruption in the record industry. This is Fresh Air. Talking about corruption in the music industry, my guest is journalist Frederick Dannen. Do the major record companies still use independent promotion people now?
They do, but they've got the last laugh. What happened is before early 1986, when that NBC News report showing two of the top members of the network meeting with John Gotti of the Gambino family was aired, the record companies were spending this $60 to $80 million on independent promotion themselves out of their own budgets. What happened after that report, when the labels started to boycott the network, the artists were so, and their managers, were so insistent on having the support of independent promotion that they began to pay for independent promotion out of their own pockets. Today, a typical arrangement would be for the record company, the major record company, to pay out money to an artist in the guise of something else, say tour support, and that money is actually being used for independent promotion. So there's yet another layer separating the record company from the bribery. It's terrific. Before, the record company would pay the network man would do the dirty work. Now it's even better. You pay the artist manager. The artist manager pays the network man. But what makes it a victory for the record companies is that because of the way the payments are doled out, they're recoupable. In other words, they can be charged against the artist's royalties, and they are. So what's happened is it still exists, but the artists are paying for it.
And the independent promotion people are still as corrupt, even after all the investigations and prosecutions?
Sure. I mean, this is a rogue industry. People seem to be amazed at the amount of corruption that's been unearthed on Wall Street. I'm not. I mean, I covered Wall Street, and Wall Street has a lot in common with the record industry. Wall Street's very deal-driven. The record industry is totally hit-driven. When your motto is whatever it takes, and you mean exactly that, then you really don't have a sense of limits. I think that's something those two businesses have in common, no sense of limits.
As of 1989, you say that the control of nearly 90% of the record industry is in the hands of six multinationals. So the six major labels are CBS, Warner, PolyGram, MCA, Capitol, and RCA Arista.
Well, actually, the sixth major label is known as BMG, for Bertelsmann Music Group. Bertelsmann is a West German company that bought RCA Records from RCA and Arista Records, which is the home of Whitney Houston.
If most of the power is in the hands of six companies, how does that affect what gets produced now?
Well, look at it like this. Say you are an artist and you have a demo tape and you want to get a record deal. 15 or 20 years ago, there were 25, 30 places to shop that tape. Now your attorney or your manager is shopping that tape to the six biggest record companies. It's true you could get a deal with an independent label like A&M, but who owns A&M? PolyGram. Or with Def Jam, but who owns Def Jam? CBS. Or with Motown, but who owns Motown? MCA. So what's happened is you really have six players, and it's an oligopoly in the true sense, because the retailers, the record stores, the rack jobbers, they're buying all of their product from six companies, all, virtually all, because those companies either are recording you or, at the very least, they're distributing you. So that means that if they don't like you, if they don't like your music, they don't feel that you have a shot, they don't distribute you, you don't get shelf space, you have no career.
Now, you also say that under today's system, only superstars who sell millions of records can make a reasonable return. But the way that contracts are structured, the record company can make a profit off an album while the artist's royalty account is still in the red. How can that be?
Record company contracts are an absolute abomination. Any time that an artist has sued and a judge has taken a look at a record contract, the case has been settled or the artist has won, because they are really contracts of adhesion, which is a polite way of saying slave labor. Absolutely everything, and I mean everything, every expense is chargeable against the artist's royalties. If Random House came to me and they said, Fred, your book's doing very well, but you know that the cost of paper and binding and advertising, that's all coming out of your royalties, so I don't think you're going to be getting a check from us. I would be appalled. And yet that is what artists have to deal with. You have to sell, you literally just about have to have a platinum album that is a million copies to make any money, any serious money off an album. And even then, sometimes you don't. Patti Smyth and Warrior had a platinum album in 1985, and they made about 10 cents a record off of that.
So what are some of the expenses that are usually charged against artist royalties?
Well, now independent promotion, which is a major expense. You could say the artists are to blame for that, but I don't know that they are. It's a system that the industry created. Another big expense is touring. The cost of making a video is a major expense. You can easily spend six figures, high six figures, making a music video. And they're considered de rigueur now. I think videos are overdone. They're more appropriate for certain types of artists than others. But the labels just keep churning them out.
What was your method of investigating the record industry?
What I tried to do was make myself very visible to the industry and very familiar, so that they would start to think of me as a quasi-insider, as if I were writing for Billboard or Variety. What I did first was go to a lot of the record industry conventions. And I also tried to cultivate, to use a term in the industry, rabbis, that is, people who were very well connected, who took a liking to me and would introduce me to other people. One thing I'm very proud of is that something like 90% of hitmen is on the record. I guess what happened is that people did get used to having me around, and I got them to relax, and they told me stories that were generally well known in the industry, but no one had ever published, and I suppose they expected that I wouldn't publish them.
Do you have any predictions where the next scandal will come from within the music industry?
I have a feeling that this ISGRO matter is going to burgeon and lead to cases involving kickbacks. ISGRO is in a position, if he desires, to, I believe, take down executives of the record industry with him, because he is believed to have paid kickbacks to many. And in fact, one person he's alleged to have paid kickbacks to, Ray Anderson, the former head of Epic, Michael Jackson's label, goes on trial with Iskrow on August 14th.
Frederick Denon's new book is Hitmen, Power Brokers and Fast Money Inside the Music Business. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, a concert of soul music and rhythm and blues with the Holmes Brothers. This is from their new album, In the Spirit.
You're so fine. So fine. Baby, you're mine. You're mine. And I walk, I talk about you. I love you. I love you. I need you. You're so fine. So fine. Baby, you're mine. You're mine. And I walk, I talk about you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jerry Zucker was part of the trio of filmmakers that made the comedies Airplane and The Naked Gun. Coming up, Zucker talks with us about his new movie, Ghost. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new album from the Boston Symphony Orchestra, a recording that Lloyd says shows the BSO does some of their best work when music director Seiji Ozawa is not on the podium. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg reveals the hidden agonies and pleasures of speaking another language. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with Jerry Zucker, part of the team that created the movies Airplane and The Naked Gun. He's just made his solo directing debut with Ghost. But first, saxophonist and flutist Rossan Roland Kirk used to say he got some of his best ideas from his dreams. It was in a dream that he first had the notion of playing several horns at the same time, which became a signature for him. The name Rossan, which he took late in life, also came to him in a dream. Kirk died in 1977 when he was 42. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says when it comes to recognizing Kirk's contribution to jazz, many people have been asleep.
Mm-hmm. Now that the LP is dead and the expensive compact disc is king, it's interesting to watch the ways record companies reissue old albums on CD. LPs used to run about 40 minutes long. CDs can hold over 75 minutes of music. But sometimes, labels reissue old albums on CD as is, filling up only half the available time. Some companies fill out the program with alternate takes or extra material from the same sessions. And some companies piggyback two LPs onto one CD, which is a good idea, though they don't do it consistently. A new CD on the MRC label combines two fine albums by Rahsaan Roland Kirk, which were recorded in the mid-60s. One is called Rip, Rig, and Panic. The other is Now Please Don't You Cry, Beautiful Edith. When Rahsaan Roland Kirk was alive, he was pretty popular, but nowadays he doesn't get nearly enough credit. The music Kirk made during the 60s paved the way for key trends in the jazz of the 70s and 80s. Wynton Marsalis and Company get a lot of press for paying tribute to the great styles of the past, but in the 60s, when the jazz world was splintered into lots of factions and musicians were expected to choose up sides, Kirk played everything from early jazz to free jazz. On the two albums on his new CD, he plays ballads, a waltz, a bossa nova, a little free stuff, and even a little cheesy electronic music. He also plays several kinds of blues. Rahsaan was a terrific blues player. Kirk didn't only jump from style to style, he also played a lot of different instruments. In doing that, he foreshadowed the Chicago avant-garde that blossomed in the late 60s and the 70s. That movement was rife with quick-change multi-instrumentalists. On his reissue, Kirk plays tenor sax, clarinet, assorted noisemakers, and two oddly shaped and pinched-sounding saxophones, the Manzello and this one, the Stritch. Kirk's work on flute was especially striking. He'd get shrieking effects by singing into it as he played. His style had a big influence on Ian Anderson, the flute player with the rock band Jethro Tull. Anderson wasn't nearly as good at it, but he made a lot more money. Here's the real thing. No matter what instrument or what kind of music he played, Rahsaan Roland Kirk was always preoccupied with the texture of sound. He loved to lay it on thick. That's how he maintained a distinctive style in such varied situations. Kirk could play two or three horns at the same time, and he did it with remarkable taste. Listen to the way he goes back and forth between multiple saxes and solo tenor on the ballad Once in a While. Thank you. it's hard to understand why Roland Kirk hasn't gotten his due. I suspect it's because his humorous and theatrical streaks offend the middlebrow sensibilities of some folks. But Kirk obviously cared deeply about every kind of music he played. If this is the work of a clown, well, I wish more of the serious players made music that's half as stimulating.
Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead, this is Fresh Air. Jerry Zucker got his start parodying other people's movies. He spoofed disaster films in Airplane and police dramas in Police Squad and The Naked Gun. He made them with his brother David and Jim Abrahams. They also co-directed Ruthless People. A sequel to The Naked Gun is in the works. Before they turned to feature films, the trio had a theater group, Kentucky Fried Theater, that spoofed TV shows and commercials. Jerry Zucker is directing on his own now. His first solo effort is Ghost, starring Demi Moore, Patrick Swayze, and Whoopi Goldberg. Swayze and Moore are lovers. He's killed by a mugger, but stays on Earth as a ghost. Whoopi Goldberg plays a phony psychic who turns out to have real supernatural powers. Zucker told me directing on his own was a different but welcomed experience.
It was a little strange at first, just sitting there behind the camera, and after I'd yell cut, I'd kind of look around to see if what David and Jim had to say, and they weren't there. The part I liked about it was that we didn't have to vote on things. I could really pursue the film as I saw it, and I think that a film like Ghost really would not have taken to the democratic process.
There's a scene where Patrick Swayze, who plays the ghost, you know, he can't physically feel anything as a ghost, but he inhabits the body of the medium, Whoopi Goldberg, so that he can touch Demi Moore one last time.
Right.
And in that passionate embrace, you see Demi Moore and Patrick Swayze. I kind of wanted to see Demi Moore and Whoopi Goldberg embracing, knowing somehow that Patrick Swayze was supposed to be in Whoopi Goldberg's body.
The audience could not have taken it. It would have been, you know, for a mainstream American audience, as the black hands, you know, touch the white hands, and we start to, you know, move, the camera moves up towards Demi's face, people start to titter. I mean, you can hear in the audience a certain percentage of people, and they're afraid that we're going to do a lesbian scene, and they really, it would make them so uncomfortable as to take everybody out of the movie. It's cost millions of dollars to make movies, and I want to see millions of people in their seats, responding to the movie and laughing and crying and enjoying it. And I just think that that's something that would have pushed most of the audience too far.
So they're not ready for it yet, the audience.
I don't think so, and I don't blame them. I mean, I'm not ready for it yet. I never talk down to the audience. I don't think if I was in the audience, I would really quite want to see that. I personally think that there, and you're not alone in your comments. There's a number of reviews that mentioned that thought that we kind of copped out there, and that we should have gone had it be the two women. But I think that, even though it seems like it could have been wonderful, I think if you would actually have seen it, it would have appeared flat, and you would have been so conscious of the fact that there's these two women hugging each other, holding each other, and I think the you would have lost what Patrick was feeling entirely, because there would have been no way to show it. And I thought, to me, that scene was about one last chance to touch. I mean, that's the part of the thing for me. It wasn't about sex. They don't kiss. They don't do anything erotic in that scene. It's just about the pure joy of touching, of being able to hold and touch someone that you love, and not to be able to see that joy on Patrick's face would have I don't think would have made the point that I wanted to make.
Let me go back to some of your earlier projects, and I'd be interested in hearing how some of those came together. How did you come up with the idea of spoofing disaster films?
When we were doing Kentucky Fried Theater, we used to spoof television commercials, and we used to tape TV commercials just to see what was, just to watch all these commercials and see what we could spoof. And we sometimes the late night commercials were the funniest. So we left the tape machine run all night, and you know, in between these commercials, we found this movie called Zero Hour, and it was an old, you know, 1957 flying movie with Dana Andrews and Sterling Hayden, and it was, you know, really funny. And we started to think, hey, this is, maybe we could do something with this, and eventually we bought the rights to it.
Oh, really? So this was more, the plot structure then came from a very specific film?
Yeah, yeah, that's very much the same plot structure. I mean, it was a serious movie, not a comedy. And it was about an airplane, and the pilot. Actually, the Dana Andrews was, his wife had just left him, and they had a son. And because he couldn't make a life for them ever since he screwed up in the war, you know, and ever since that one thing that happened. And then there was food poisoning, and of course he was the only person on the plane who could fly it, so he had to fly the plane in, and that was basically the plot. And I, you know, we changed a lot of things, but we really took that that basic premise.
That's really funny, because I thought the food poisoning was the most, like, preposterous part of the whole plot.
Well, there's actually a line in that movie where the doctor on the plane, who is, you know, is taking this all very seriously. I mean, there's really not a light moment at all in this movie. And he says to the stewardess, the life of everybody on board this plane depends on one thing, finding someone back there who can not only fly this plane, but who didn't have fish for dinner. And it's just, we just took that line right from that movie. And of course, in Airplane, it appears as a gag line.
Yeah, I'm really just shocked that actually came from something.
Yeah, no. If you ever catch the, if you ever see it in the newspaper, you know.
Oh, I'll be there. Yeah, I'll be there.
It's especially after you've seen Airplane, it's funny to watch.
Some of the people who you cast in the movie include Peter Graves, Lloyd Bridges, Robert Stack, Leslie Nielsen. Were these some of your favorite washed-up actors?
Well, we always liked those shows. It's interesting with all the we always used to say that you could only parody a movie that you had some affection for. And I think the same thing, I mean, the movie Zero Hour, we laughed at, but we also kind of liked. It was a fun movie. You really did want to see how it ended, and you kind of liked the characters. And even though there were a lot of corny lines and things that you made fun of, you still liked it. And we feel the same way about those actors. We liked them all. We liked watching them. We used to love the Untouchables. We always watched Sea Hunt. You know, Leslie Nielsen was in every movie ever made. I mean, he's just, you couldn't, in every television show, he was like, you know, a fixture whose, you know, name nobody quite knew, but he was, you know, he was a very famous actor. And we just told these guys when we first talked to them, when we first met, that we just wanted to play it straight. We wanted them to not really just to not even so much playing it straight, but even further pretending like they didn't even know it was a comedy. We wanted them to play it exactly like they did in their old movies, and in Sea Hunt and The Untouchables and Mission Impossible. And they all agreed, and they were very good sports about it, and they really understood that that's what it would take to make it work. And you know, if those guys had been kind of winking and having fun with it, it would have been a disaster.
Were any of them offended that you were casting them in this spoof?
No, none of the ones that did it, obviously they wouldn't have done it otherwise. We did offer it to some people that wanted nothing to do with it. I mean, you know, I think Carl Malden turned us down for one of the parts, and he just, you know, said, I don't want anything to do with this piece of junk, or something like that.
When you were making Ghost, did you ever have the impulse to make a parody of your own film, since you make such good parodies?
Well, funny you mention that. We are parodying some scenes from Ghost. Now that it looks like it's going to be a big enough hit, we're going to parody some scenes from it in the Naked Gun sequel.
Oh, that's great. Which
yeah.
scenes?
I think is hysterical. David actually called me last week, and he had seen the movie again, and he said, you know, that pottery scene is a classic. We gotta spoof this. We have to have Leslie and Priscilla over at Potter's Wheel and have it get out of control. And I was hysterical. I thought it was great.
Well, just to explain this Potter's Wheel thing, the Demi Moore character is a potter, and she's making this particularly phallic-like sculpture when Patrick Swayze comes into the room and they start to embrace passionately with this phallic-like thing spinning around on the Potter's Wheel.
It's a perfect scene. It's absolutely a scene. If I hadn't done it, I would want to spoof it. I mean, it really is very ripe for it. So I think it should be. But it's so rare to get the opportunity to make fun of your own work.
But tell me, did you mean that to be as phallic-like as it was?
Well, not yes and no. I mean, we certainly thought about it, but we didn't. You know, it just sort of happens that way by itself. As a matter of fact, there were many takes where it got more phallic, and we kept toning it down. I specifically liked the idea of the two of them sitting at this thing, and just the erotic nature of two people putting their hands in this wet clay, and then the idea of going from this kind of vessel that this pot that she's making to this sort of phallic lump was just something that kind of happened.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thank you very much, Terry. It's a pleasure.
Jerry Zucker directed the new film, Ghost. This is Fresh Air. I'm Linda Wertheimer in Washington. This afternoon on All Things Considered, we will be leading with the story from Trinidad and Tobago, where the prime minister has been freed. He is wounded. The other hostages are still being held. The oil spill in Galveston Bay is reportedly worse than authorities at first thought, possibly the worst oil spill in the lower 48 states. It's bigger, and the oil is toxic, and it's moving across Galveston Bay. The PGA is making a decision this afternoon about whether to move the tournament from Birmingham, Alabama. Memphis seems to be a possibility. That's on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg is just back from visiting France, and he has this reflection on what speaking French does to him.
I used to flatter myself I was one of those people who can speak a foreign language in moderation, with complete self-control. Just one more sentence and I'm out of here. It was massive self-deception. If travel is broadening, I was all over the floor. The first step down this road is the physical impersonation of a Frenchman. I suppose it's possible to speak French from an American slouch, but it's not easy. It's like trying to throw a trout line from a hammock. Before you launch your mouth into the delicate ballistics of French pronunciation, you have to assume a particular vocal posture. Your tongue is poised in the front of your mouth, like a quarterback waiting for the snap. Your lips are thrust forward in the distinctive pout called l'amou. All of this exerts a subtle pull on the rest of your anatomy. Your larynx rises in your throat so that your voice comes out higher and more shrill than it would in English. Mais ça, alors, c'est insupportable. This tenses the muscles of your neck and draws your shoulders up in a shrug. You compensate by churning your hands palms up in front of you. You find yourself inhabiting the body of a stranger. Now you understand why they're called aliens. Impersonation is followed by prevarication. I was sitting with a table full of cousins and cousines, and the flush of the wine persuaded me to launch into an involved histoire about how I once broke my ankle coming down the gangplank of a ferry boat. I was just getting started when I realized that I couldn't remember the words for ankle or gangway. So I conveniently rearranged my pass to make it a broken foot and a department store escalator. A few occasions like this, and I began to change my conversational strategy. Where in English I might be saying to myself, what do I really believe about this? Now I found myself thinking, is there anything relevant to this that I know how to say? I walk down the street editing my life until I have a version I can report in French. After a while, the editing process becomes automatic. The world seems to package itself in French-sized bites. I'm thinking in French, or at least thinking for French. This is supposed to be the great breakthrough in mastery of a foreign language. Except that my thoughts are just like my French, crude and broken. I cease to make distinctions. I no longer perceive any difference between crimson, scarlet, and russet. They're all just red. Where I once would have paused to choose among cranky, crabby, sullen, grouchy, or gloomy, now I operate with one vague category of unhappiness. Every once in a while, it strikes me that maybe I'm missing some details. Hang on a second, let me try and think this through in English. But I can't clear my head of this Gallic haze. In fact, the worst of all this is that I don't even realize what's happening to me. I'm just so pleased with myself, sitting there chattering fatuously, my body held in a contorted posture, and eating parts of the cow that English doesn't even have names for. Until a month later, I wake up in San Francisco with a jet lag hangover and my new French clothes strewn over the floor, and I close my eyes and say, oh God, was that me?
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Roberta Shurrock, Joan Tui, and Rossan Bucci. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a live concert with the Holmes Brothers, a group that sings gospel, soul, and rhythm and blues. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.